Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Our guest on today's program is Jeff Valletta, co-founder and CEO of Fahrenheit 212, a New York-based innovation consultancy that invents and brings to market new products, services, and businesses for Fortune 500 companies. Welcome to Edgewise, Jeff.
Thank you.
Okay, let's start with the basics. What is the usual method for innovation in large organizations?
It depends on the culture of the organization, of course, and what it's setting out to do. It's not that the outsourcing of innovation has replaced the R&D department. It supplements the R&D department. Mm-hmm. To be fair, a good amount of the innovation that is done inside organizations is still the primary responsibility of the company's innovation team, sometimes called the R&D department and more frequently called the innovation department.
So the word innovation does appear.
Yeah, it does now. When you look at the types of people inside organizations that give Fahrenheit jobs, it's the corporate strategy team, the R&D team, somebody looking after a balance sheet, a president of a division. But increasingly, it's somebody called the chief innovation officer, which is a title that didn't exist 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay, so could you describe a little bit the innovation process?
There are two types of innovation. There is what the market would call renovation innovation, which is the bulk of innovation efforts. And that's simply the maintaining of the vitality mm-hmm. of brands and businesses and the requirement of those businesses to throw off the 2, 3, 4% of growth quarter in, year out. The second kind of innovation is best defined as anything that isn't renovation.
Right.
It's called disruptive or transformational innovation.
Okay.
But the two characteristics of every job that we do are, one, it will require the company to do something it is very unfamiliar with doing today. And secondly, it's associated with large-scale growth. It's very rare that the company isn't requiring at least $150 million of net new revenues over some defined period of time.
Can you talk for a minute about the roles that testing and prototyping play in the innovation process?
The first overriding principle is don't go to a marketplace and believe that they've got the answer. Research plays a very fundamental role, but the sequencing of what you're researching and how you research is very, very fundamental.
Right.
Often in the first phase of our work, there is research that is conducted, but we're not looking for answers. We're looking at a better definition of what we're setting out to transform. And the sharper you can get that point of definition about what you're setting out to transform, the far more likely you are to be successful. When we develop a solution or a set of solutions, we develop them in a fashion that is incredibly formed. They're very dimensional. They are all done as a video prototype. It's not just the product and its benefit set, but it's wrapped up in the context of life.
Mm-hmm.
That context will be familiar to somebody. The product will be unfamiliar.
Right. Right.
So your ability to make a judgment as a consumer about whether or not that would change your behavior is a function of how dimensionally we have developed the idea. Concept testing, I have a real issue with.
Well, why is that?
People don't buy concepts, so how can they comment on a concept? You don't walk through a supermarket and buy a concept. You buy a product.
Of course.
It's very common for us to be in the research phase of our work. And people think it already exists. It's just not in Boston or in Shanghai where we happen to be talking to them. So the first principle is don't ask them to invent the future. But mum's a great consumer.
Uh-huh.
When I've got something ready for her to consume, give it to her in a fashion that is familiar, put it into a familiar context and make it as dimensional as you possibly can. So she has a much better ability to make a judgment mm-hmm. about whether or not that's going to change your behavior or it isn't. One of the fundamental differences between advertising and innovation is that you are looking not to sell your work, you are truly using the marketplace to make it better.
Hmm.
Some of the best ideas we've ever had, we didn't take them to research. They came as a function of giving consumers 4 or 5 things to talk about, and the intersection between a couple of them formed a new insight and a new opportunity to create. So research plays a very fundamental role, but do it with your eyes open. You are absolutely looking to make it more accurate rather than to convince somebody that this is right.
Right. So what you're saying is research for a better definition.
Sure. Certainly at the outset. Creativity works when it's got very little wriggle room and doesn't work very well when it's got lots of open space.
Exactly.
The more definition, the more boundaries you put on creativity, the more creative people are. Creative people work brilliantly in a defined control environment.
Yep.
Give creative people license, latitude, freedom, time, and it's the inverse of what you think. It's materially unhelpful.
Okay, but can you explain what you mean by that?
Sure. Having too much time is the same as having too much money. It's just not helpful. We do big, complicated, novel things, and we work for big, complex organizations. And if you give people too much time, you give them an opportunity to get scared, to fear the leaps that they've made on the journey.
Right.
And to believe that it is random, that it isn't codifiable, and it isn't a function of incredible discipline and a process is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
The best way to start the magic journey is to have a very tightly defined definition of exactly what you're setting out to transform.
Okay, so how do you get the idea?
There is a process.
So why don't you tell us about that?
Not one person in the company works on one thing. Nobody's dedicated to a job. Everybody is working on at least four jobs concurrently. And an enormous amount of the stimulation and perspective that you get for this particular challenge that you're working to is a function of other things that you're working on or other things that you have worked on. Enormous stimulation comes from applying something that's typical in one space that's not typical in another. The second thing is that unlike an ad agency where an ad is the responsibility of a copywriter and an art director or a management consultancy company, mm-hmm. which is by and large a function of an engagement manager and two associates working on a program, who are totally responsible for defining the problem and solving it amongst themselves. At Fahrenheit, there are 14 people in Money and Magic that work on every given job. So you work in tandem and you work in tension all the way through that process. But it's a meritocracy. The best idea is the best idea, whoever it's come from. Everybody has accountabilities and responsibilities on various stages of that food chain. But you're in the comfort of having and being stimulated by mm-hmm. bright people helping to find an appropriate solution.
Right.
And then there are just a number of techniques. The most important is there's always a bigger question behind the question that you're being asked. And if you solve the bigger question, you'll find that the one in front of you virtually goes away.
Right. Now let's look at what the creative process is.
Every challenge that we're given takes a 5-month period to get to a set of formed commercial solutions that have been vetted and validated in a market, ready for a company to make their determination to resource this to market.
Right.
Three steps in that. The first step is to end up with a definition of what you're setting out to mm-hmm. transform and why you believe that with the right idea, there is growth, an opportunity for the scale that you're looking for. And at that point, the journey of invention, of applied creativity takes place within a controlled set of very clear guidelines for what it is you're setting out to transform and some very opportune, exciting, richly defined spaces in which you believe with an idea the right solution can take place. So what the team will do is develop a notion, mm-hmm. a partially formed idea, a sketch before the painting, and develop a whole set of those notions. Normally, at least twice as many as you will ultimately require. And then one of the most helpful things in the whole process at that point is to bounce those notions off mm-hmm. other people. And importantly, off the company that you're actually doing the business for.
Right. So why is it important?
It's the time that companies are most valuable to the project and to us because they've now got something to push against. Mm-hmm. All their prejudices, all their hypotheses, and all their prior experiences are now working into something or against something, mm-hmm. and they become incredibly meaningfully useful. I've given them something novel to think about, and we use them very, very heavily, not as a vetting process, but as somebody that's going to make the work that we're doing that much more likely to be accurate.
Right. So what is the next step?
Then we make a selection process halfway through that second phase where we take those notions and we determine what now is going to be taken from a notion to a fully dimensional idea. And at that point, other creative skill sets come to bear on it. The whole world of design now starts being brought into that process, and we need to start turning an idea into a product, and that product needs shape, form, and definition. And that's where you bring in engineering skills and your industrial design skills and graphic design capabilities to take that notional thought from an idea into a physical product. It's where the money team comes back into the equation and start framing the commercial case and the financial case that supports this journey from a fledgling notion to an idea to a physical product.
Now, your background before Fahrenheit was advertising. How does your previous experience help you?
The most important transferable skill set was the ability to tell stories, mm-hmm. an ability to elevate and articulate an idea into something that is tangible and meaningful and inspiring. We need to get people comfortable and confident about something that doesn't exist today before it exists. But it's fundamentally different from advertising. We are a pre-market business rather than an in-market business. So we have nothing to do with the world of marketing services per se. We get products to market rather than make them more attractive once they're in the market. naivety was really helpful.
Right.
The way that we dimensionalized and developed worked and started to do video prototypes and so on was just a belief that that's the way you would do it.
Sure.
But it wasn't the way people did it. And I would believe that a very significant amount of products failed because they were poorly articulated rather than because they were poor ideas.
Okay, here's another question. What role do you play in the innovation process?
I've stepped away from being involved in the product or contributing to the product. One of the sad things about a business that's growing is that you've got to stop doing it. I made a call almost 2 years ago now that for us to grow as a business, I had to stand away from being involved in the product. So my role at Fahrenheit is nothing to do with the product. Primarily, I'm about growth. My partner's about advancing the product. My role is about advancing the business. So most of my life, I'm out prospecting in the biggest and broader sense of that world.
That's very interesting. Then what do you do as a leader?
My role as a leader is very straightforward. I've got some simple principles about what constitutes leadership, and I truly believe that people want to be led. They want to know what to do, and they want to know that what they're doing is important, and they want to know that frequently. The less disciplined you are about that, or the more infrequent you are about doing that, the more you create voids. The moment you create voids, you create fear and uncertainty, and people will fill the void in with some degree of negativity. So ensure that at no point is the team not aware about what they're to do, and that transparently and uniformly across the company, people know that what they're actually doing is fundamentally important. The second thing is it's much, much better to give somebody lots more of what they're good at doing than it is to fix people's weaknesses.
Absolutely.
So if you have somebody who's just not competent, not good enough, struggles with something, don't ask them to do it. But the most important role for a leader is to be consistent, not to surprise people. It doesn't mean to say that you can't change your mind or that things don't change direction. Of course they do. But so many times somebody tells you to do something and then they expressly did something at odds with that, and then you start questioning integrity and values. So I pride myself on uniformity.
And is there anything else that you've found?
Yeah. One of the incredible things about innovation is it's probably the only practice in the world where failure is entirely anticipated, expected, and worse than that, entirely tolerated. The lack of predictability and the failure rates in innovation are known and talked about and accepted. And that is absolutely nonsensical.
It really is. How did you address that?
Fahrenheit set itself up and built a business that is the only company in its space in the world that gets paid to perform. We're totally an outcome-obsessed business because we're an outcome-paid company. We identify the transformational difference that can happen in getting commercial action and getting products to market. Fahrenheit is a company that solves for the business and it solves for the consumer all the way through a job.
I just have another question here. Can you talk to us a little bit about creative block?
Creative block is often a function of isolation. We've all read about writers' frustrations and writers' block. In fact, we had an amazing presentation the other day from the president of a very successful Israeli chocolate business that's now coming to America. And all the way till he was in his mid-20s, he was absolutely convinced he was going to be a great writer. A great writer had to be a tortured soul. So he deprived himself for parts of his life. But going back to the question that you asked, it's well known that people get writer's block.
Yeah, exactly.
And certainly it's fair to say that Fahrenheit's had solutions that were better than other solutions, but it doesn't suffer from creative block because there are lots of people solving the problem, not one person. It's helped enormously and stimulated enormously by working on lots of things concurrently. I have not observed any time people suffering for a lack of an idea.
Jeff, can you give us an example or two of the innovation process?
Yeah, sure. There's one in the marketplace at the moment.
Can you talk about that?
The challenge that we were set was from Samsung in their division that makes LCD screens. Their issue was not that they had chosen the wrong technology. LCD had at that point proven itself to be the enduring technology over its competitive plasma product. And there was still a significant amount of market penetration to come, which was good because it is an extremely complicated, expensive technology to make.
And what was the problem?
The problem was the price was falling, and it was falling faster than any law said it should. So they came to us and said, there are three places today where LCD screens play out. There's mobile phones, computers, and TVs and displays. Create a new market. Create new applications, new uses for LCD screens outside of those three verticals. It'll give us some market power. It'll give us back pricing power. That was the challenge, the scale of the job. We had to deliver solutions that were capable of delivering at least 600,000 units a year at a screen size 10 inches or bigger. And they had to be in market within 3 years.
Wow.
And during that time, there was going to be no technology development. So basically the screen as it was then would be the screen and whatever new application you found. So we had to go and find new applications, new uses for LCD screen. Very typical job, very exciting job.
Yeah.
One of the spaces that we identified was vending machines. And we picked vending for three primary reasons. One is it was big enough. 2% of the world's vending machine industry was 600,000 units. So we knew we had a good enough idea. We certainly had a big enough addressable audience to deliver against. Secondly, the vending machine industry had gone backwards over the previous 15 years because it had no reason to go forward. It was as much an inert object as it was in the 50 years since it had been invented. And the third thing, from a commercial point of view, what we were really excited about was three companies in the world dominate vending: Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and a company in Japan called Suntory. And our ability to create a market by consolidation in that market made success more likely.
Right. So what did you do?
We developed a solution where we replaced a vending machine window with a screen.
Hmm.
That screen allowed everything that was in that machine to be now dynamically communicated rather than statically communicated as a Coke logo on the side of the vending machine itself. And it allowed you, in a very attractive way, to create a whole lot of consumer interplay and interaction. But what was novel about the idea and what the invention was the ability of those machines to be networked together so that Coke, Pepsi, or Suntory could sit in their headquarters and use this machine now as a media platform and put one message out to 5 million screens.
That's amazing.
Or 5 million different messages to a screen each and instantaneously watch what happens as a consequence of it rather than just using it as a static distributor of their product.
Right.
So we created this idea. We developed for Samsung that solution and a set of IP, and they went out to the marketplace to license that IP. They licensed it first to Coca-Cola Company. They subsequently licensed it to others, to Unilever, to Kraft. Those companies are starting now to build out the penetration of this idea called network vending.
Is it not being advertised?
Not advertised, manufactured and put into a marketplace. So we're starting to see in the Northeast the arrival of these interactive vending machines. They're being advanced through a relationship that Coca-Cola has with a big mall operator. Mm-hmm. And there's also been significant manufacturing underway for this product in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Okay. This is an interesting question I have for you. What role do you like the client to play in the product or service development process?
This is a cultural question rather than a process question. And we have all extremes. It's what they want to do rather than we've got to wait.
Your challenge is to keep it on track.
Sure. There's a discipline. They've got to adhere to that discipline. They've got to adhere to the timeframes. There are certainly one or two times in the process when it's best that they're not around. But how much you want to be involved in the process is culturally your decision, not mine. Often when dealing in Korea with, say, Samsung or LG, knowledge transfer is fundamentally important. They want to be learning the whole time.
Right.
The other extreme, it's very typical for us to be used by a client who will only come back and join it at the back end of it when you have something worth resourcing to marketplace. And then there are things in the middle.
Mm. And just to wrap this up, is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, sure. Going back to the fallacy about innovation, how easily accepted and tolerated failure is, we've set up a business to see if we can defy that. It's a sole purpose and justification and reason for Fahrenheit.
Right.
We are setting out to create a business that step changes the rate of predictability, appreciating that innovation's only equity is uncertainty. We're at this really uncertain end of it, the transformational or disruptive end where failure rates are even more pronounced. We have built a business and a process, a philosophy, a practice, and a value proposition solely aimed at outcomes. We aren't interested in the fascinating. We are interested only in the outcome. We are an outcome-obsessed business because in large part we are an outcome-paid business. We're the only company in the world where two-thirds of the revenue that we would expect to earn on any given job is put at risk. And our clients define the commercial milestones and the metrics for success, and we get paid if we hit them, and we don't if we don't. The way that we operate ourselves inside our organization is exactly the same. We operate in 100-day cycles. And everybody in the company is involved in the determination of what's fundamentally important to us for the next 100 days. You write your plan as a derivative of that list. You score yourself. 50% of the profit of Fahrenheit is distributed back to the company directly related to your 100-day plan score.
Right.
We've only been in business as a standalone company for 5 years, and we operate in a world where it takes 2 or 3 years for products to get to market and to start performing. But already we have transformed the rate of predictability. 91% of the times that we've undertaken a job, clients have resourced and invested in that solution to market.
We've been speaking to Jeff Valletta, co-founder and CEO of Fahrenheit 212. Jeff, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
With only an internet connection and a browser, you can tap into AMA's world-class training. The American Management Association is bringing live instructor-led training right to your desktop. AMA's new virtual seminar offering features a live virtual format that is highly interactive and very user-friendly. It's taught by the same expert, world-class faculty that run our classroom sessions, and the high-quality content has been specially engineered to run in an online format. You get real-time online interaction with your course leader and your fellow attendees. You will receive a USB headset so that you can not only listen but talk to your classmates and your instructor. So take advantage of these offerings, enhance your career journey by building your skills, and you don't have to take any time away from the office. For more information about AMA's virtual seminar offering, visit our website at www.amanet.org. We'd love to get your feedback on today's program. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.